Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, sitting in today for Chris Boyd. If you close your eyes, I bet you can picture it. The food pyramid. The rice, bread, pasta, all that at the base. Butter and steak closer to the top. We learned at a young age that fat makes us fat. Writer Jeff Wilser says that's just one of the many health myths we've chewed up and swallowed. He's author of the new book, The Good News About What's Bad for You and The Bad News About What's Good for You. Jeff Wilser, welcome to Think.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So why did you want to write this book?
Well, I think a lot of us, I have been frankly confused for years trying to follow this wacky world of health. It seems like one week soy is good. Next week, soy is bad. Fish is good. Fish is bad. And there seem to be all these studies that contradict one another. So I kind of wanted to say, all right, is it true that fat is bad or sometimes is good? And so I wanted to have a book that explores the upside of what's quote unquote bad for us and the darker side of what's quote unquote good for us and try and put it all in perspective.
So much of the book does focus on health and food and diet myths. So explain how it came to be seen that fat, eating fat, makes you fat.
You know, years ago, back in the 50s and 60s, when the heart attacks were a national absolute crisis, there were teams and teams and teams of scientists and doctors who wanted to try and find out what's the problem, why are always heart attacks. And they chose saturated fat as kind of the main culprit of this. And they found a correlation in other countries of countries high in saturated fat in countries that have a high risk of heart attacks. And they, especially the scientist Ancel Keys, he really had what in his mind was as striking as cigarettes causing lung cancer. And so for years, we said, all right, have less saturated fat. That's going to cause heart attacks. So have less meat, have less butter. And we've latched upon fat as a main thing to avoid in a diet. And if in the past 50 years, if we had replaced fat with spinach, we'd probably be okay. But a lot of times we just replaced fat with more starches and more carbs. And I'm certainly not at all the first person to propose this theory. There have been, you know, the whole wing of the health community that has now kind of embraced this idea. But this is one example of how we can be obsessed about one issue in health and kind of miss the big picture.
And you write that this villain or hero, depending on how you see him, Ancel Keys, a physiologist who spent decades trying to prove that saturated fat is terrible and that fat is terrible, he did more to change America's diet than any one person, you write, in the 20th century.
I think you can argue that. Like when you look at how, just the way you described it a minute ago, how many of us were brought up as children to think about food. You know, my one takeaway from like third grade when it comes to health, like I've forgotten almost everything else, right? I remember learning about the presidents. I remember learning about math. When it comes to health, that food pyramid is still burned in my mind. And I just remember eating, all right, you're supposed to eat lots of rice, lots of pasta. And at the top, just, you know, only on very special occasions can you have something like steak or butter. When now plenty of studies suggest, those chemical alternatives to butter, like, you know, margarine or other kind of chemical freakazoid, you know, butter replacements might not be any better or could be even worse. So if you're going to have something like butter, you might as well have actual honest-to-God butter.
It's funny because perhaps we call it the food pyramid, and it creates this sort of sacred connotation because it's a pyramid. It's like the Ten Commandments or something.
Totally. And I think also this is just my personal theory, but as kids, we learn about this, as you say, this sacred pyramid. At the same time, we learn about things like basic math. We learn what presidents are. I'm pretty sure I was taught about the food pyramid around when I was taught that George Washington was our first president. So when you're like 9 years old or whatever, you assign kind of logical and truthful equivalency to those different facts. Yep, George Washington, first president, food pyramid, fat equals bad. And it's rare that we, later on in life, challenge those basic assumptions we learned as kids.
And salt is another ingredient that's interesting you write about. It's also crucial to our survival, and it's gotten quite a bad reputation. How'd that happen?
You know, I think that we like to seize upon any kind of food or really most topics as either and assign it a label of good or bad. And it is true that people who are sensitive to this and have too much sodium in their diet, at a certain dosage, it's definitely true that can be a risk for health issues, no question. But the irony is, recent studies have suggested that actually people are equally at risk by having too little salt in their diet. And so we tend to think, oh, salt is bad. Therefore, let's have a low-sodium diet. Therefore, let's look in a grocery store. Let's buy like low-sodium alternatives. And for some people, that makes sense for sure. But for a good chunk of the population, not only is that not necessary, it might even be counterproductive.
Now, I know that you're not a physician, and neither am I, but what could be dangerous about having too little sodium?
That's a good question. And I think that most of these studies look at longitudinal links between diets and their health outcomes. And so I don't know that we, for a fact, have the exact chain of logic of, okay, what chemically is hurting or helping us? I don't pretend to know the nuts and bolts physics of that. But I think that often health experts look at long-term risks. Like, okay, this population had a plus 7% chance of mortality. This population, minus 5%. And they draw conclusions based on those, how that math tips. So that's often why we see, okay, in this population, they tended to have adverse consequences. Therefore, let's cut back on salt. What happens often when we see a study that might be a modest lift in risk, that's then portrayed in the media as salt causes heart attacks. And that's true in some contexts, but not necessarily.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we've touched on fat and salt, and we've also touched on, or now let's touch on alcohol. And it's worth mentioning here that there was a point in time when beer actually saved many Americans' lives. And the science author Stephen Johnson explains it in his PBS series, How We Got to Now. Let's listen to a little bit of that.
I don't normally have beer for breakfast, but actually, for thousands of years, this was the healthiest way to start the day. Ancestors liked to have a drink or two. Benjamin Franklin, in his diaries, recalled how his colleagues would have a pint of beer before breakfast, and then they'd have a pint with breakfast, and a pint between breakfast and lunch. And of course, you have to have some beer with lunch. By the way, this is the point at which I need a nap, but they would charge on and have a pint around 6 p.m., and then, of course, a pint to celebrate the end of a hard day's work. Now, this may seem a little excessive, but it's not quite as crazy as you might think.
That was science author Stephen Johnson in the PBS series How We Got to Now. So beer was considered healthy back in those days because it was often safer to drink than water. And as it turns out, beer still isn't that bad for you, right, Jeff Wilser?
Sign me up for that diet. Where do I get the pre-breakfast beer plan? That sounds great. Yeah, I think, well, in that's it's a lovely segment, and I think that echoes a lot of what we've seen throughout history. There was a time way back in the day when they bathed babies in wine, not water, because water was too dirty and might have diseases. Even though in today's modern era, when generally, hopefully, most of your listeners, we all have water that's healthier than sewage to bathe in and probably cleaner than beer. Even in our times now, though, study after study after study has suggested, at the very least, a link between moderate health benefits and alcohol. Some of these studies are purely correlation. So one could always say, well, was that causation or is it correlation? Other studies, though, really have clinically shown, all right, there is likely a physiological benefit to alcohol. And when I first heard this, I was deeply skeptical. I think we've all heard of, we've all been at a dinner party where there's like that guy who pours the red wine and he says like with a wink, oh, red wine's good for your heart. And like he's the first person
sounds
to make that joke.
Sounds very creepy when you put it like that.
Yeah, I've seen that guy too many times. We all have. So I think that we've all heard that. And I, though, thought that was kind of an old wives' tale. It seemed too good to be true. But the reality is that studies really have shown a modest benefit when it's drank, and this is the big, big, big asterisk, in moderation.
Why is that advice, which you hear on everything, moderation, so unsatisfying?
Because no one likes moderation, right? It sounds terrible. Like, if I'm enjoying some food, I want more and more and more of it. So I think it's human nature to rail against that idea. The irony is, as cliche as it sounds, it happens to be really explanatory for most health studies. It cracked me up doing the research in this book, reading these studies in like document after document, whether it's about something like alcohol, whether it's about salt, or whether it's about a psychological issue like complaining or profanity. These experts who conduct these trials say, well, you know, and a little, it's the effect is helpful up until a point. Then there's diminishing returns. So it's this kind of issue that transcends all of health and psychology, the idea of dosage. And even though it sounds, again, it sounds kind of simplistic, well, of course, moderation, it really does explain why we see this apparent back and forth on health, because we see a study, all right, you know, bacon's good, bacon's bad. And the issue might be one study says it's bad at like 5 slices a day. The other study says 1 slice a day, it's no big deal. Both of these studies are true, yet they seem to contradict each other the way they're framed.
You mentioned some of the non-food related subjects in your book, and gossiping is one that's often seen, almost always, as a bad thing. It's a no-no in schools and workplaces, even church. So what could be good about gossip?
Yeah, it's and I think it's fair to say it usually is, does have a negative role. But there are some sociologists who have a theory that while gossip certainly has a dark side, it also serves an important social function in helping establish and reinforce cultural norms. So let's imagine you're in a workplace. What's a better kind of incentive to act behaved? Is it, well, I read in my corporate HR brochure on page 37, byline C, I read that one shouldn't do XYZ, or is it a more useful kind of curb or boundary if someone says, geez, I know I really shouldn't hook up with that person because people will gossip about it. It's powerful.
It's a very powerful tool. All right, we're going to be getting to more of the unconventional wisdom that Jeff Wilser writes about in his book. You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in today for Chris Boyd. And we're talking about the good news about what's bad for you and the bad news about what's good for you. So the possible benefits of skipping breakfast and cursing more, and the possible downsides of yoga, diet food, and vitamins. You can join our conversation. Call 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet. I'm @LSilverwoman. We'll be back with more from Jeff Wilser after a short break.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. What's better for you, books or TV? My guest, Jeff Wilser, says the answer isn't so clear-cut. He's author of The Good News About What's Bad for You and The Bad News About What's Good for You. Jeff Wilser, make me feel better about binging on Netflix.
So first off, I should say I would never make the claim that categorically TV is better for you than books.
Oh, darn.
So I want to get that out there. That said, I have been known to binge myself. I give everyone a pass for binging now and then. And I think, though, but when you frame it as what's better for you, let's say a very kind of brain dead beach read or The Wire. That's a tougher call. What's more stimulating? And you could, I think that various sociologists have argued, well, in this golden era of television, narratively, the way TV shows are structured, the nuance of these shows requires the same kind of firing of our synapses and neurons to follow the plots that we would require reading a great 19th century novel. So it might be that it's might not quite as black and white as TV equals bad and lazy, books equals good for you. One psychologist also has a theory that even for the, let's face it, even for the bad TV, so forget all of our Netflix and HBO prestige shows, even for the really awful stuff, there could be a benefit of having the guilty pleasure of indulging in that. Some experiments suggest that has a way of restoring our willpower, that by letting our brains kind of zone out for a bit on something like TV, we are better able to then marshal our energy for the task at hand in the future.
Interesting. By watching other people with low willpower, perhaps we can muster our own.
Exactly.
And I do have to say, following the storyline for me and the legal arguments of shows like How to Get Away with Murder, keep me much more engaged, or I find I have to repeat scenes because I'm not understanding them much more so than I do in some books. So
totally. I have to at times turn subtitles on, yeah. Watch scenes a few times. I mean, some shows require practically in the same way you would to read an old Russian novel, right? There's the first 10 pages with the character names and bios. It requires that for some shows on HBO now. Same kind of thing.
Interesting. So research on stress has also turned up interesting news. What's the verdict? Is stress good or bad for us, or is it another case of moderation?
It's, well, like many things, it has trade-offs. And we tend to think about things like stress as either a blanket, good, bad, black, white. And I think some research suggests that certainly stress can have very serious negative health consequences. No question. There have been gobs of studies linking stress to things like death and even worse, like hair loss for men, right? There's all kinds of downside. But one theory is that when we frame stress differently, when we think of stress as a tool that our body uses to rise to the occasion and that unleashes adrenaline, in the same way that biologically millennia ago we evolved to have stress when bears chased us. We got stressed and we fled from bears. By that same kind of fight or flight paradigm, if we think of that as a positive tool to use in short bursts for specific purposes, that has been correlated to actually physiologically better health. So to me, the fascinating thing is, even if we change, if we don't even change our exercise, if we don't change what we eat, if we change the way that we think about stress, that can actually make us feel better and feel healthier.
So just changing the way we see stress. I mean, I generally see it as a bad thing, and I say, "Oh, I'm stressed out," and that stresses me out more. You're saying if you could think of it as how?
Well, the one example a psychologist gave me during research for this book was, let's imagine during the holidays, let's say you have in-laws and family coming to visit, and you're like, "Oh no, I have to clean the house up. I'm stressed." If you simply think of this as, all right, I only have 35 minutes to get the entire house in order, I am stressed, and think of that as, okay, it's a good thing I'm stressed because I will move faster, I will tidy up things will get done. My house will be in order by the time that the in-laws arrive. If you think of that as a way your body is helping you out by rising to the occasion, that could actually have a beneficial kind of halo for your overall health, and that you're it's not by changing your mindsets long term, you could be healthier. There's a book called The Upside of Stress that delves into this in far more detail. It's a really interesting concept.
Interesting. Well, there's another biblical no-no that you write about, spite. And there's actually a handy scale to gauge your own spitefulness in your book. I don't know if you remember any of that, but you talk about how to test how spiteful you are.
Of course, yeah. There's a doctor I spoke to who created the world's first spitefulness scale, and he gave people like a 20-question list, and there were examples such as, would you rather get I'm making this up, but there were things like, would you rather get a small salary increase or imagine the person you hate most at work has a salary reduction of 10%? So people who, and based on your answers to this, you get graded a certain spitefulness level. And I'm pretty proud to find out that my score was pretty spiteful. So I don't know what that says about me, but I think he said I was in the top 95th percentile of spite. So,
there's another one. I just want to add that here's another question. If I'm going to my car in a crowded parking lot and it seems like another driver wants my space, I will take my time pulling out.
You could almost call this the Larry David scale, right?
Yes, it was the Larry David scale of curb your enthusiasm. So what could possibly be good about spite?
Well, the spite expert I spoke to said he was a defender of spite, right? And even he was skeptical that it necessarily boosted your own health. However, similar to how gossip might play an important cultural role in kind of guiding our norms, spite also could be useful for society, and that even the person who's waiting in the car, the people who tend to be spiteful, they often have a moral, when you think about it, they often have some moral principle they're angry about, right? They're grumpy, like, oh, that guy broke code, he cut in line, so I'm going to be spiteful. So one theory is these spite kind of watchdogs, by being spiteful, they tend to curb others to have appropriate conduct. So if people are cutting in line, they might incur the wrath of the spite people. So it's not so much that spite is going to be like great for your own health, but you might be paradoxically doing a service to society in your own sneaky way by being spiteful.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in today for Chris Boyd, and we're talking about the good news about what's bad for you and the flip side, the bad news about what's good for you. You can join the conversation by calling 800-933-5372. Let's go to the phones now to Carlos in Dallas.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I heard this the guests talk about how people use stress positively. I own a interior design firm, and I'm also a professional artist, so you can imagine that everything is on a time scale. I've noticed that I'm always stressed out, and even when I'm not stressed out, I get really anxious and nervous because it's like I don't have that stress to push me. And my fear is that it's going to get me in trouble or I'm going to do something crazy and outrageous because I don't have that stress to drive me. Now, I was just wondering to know what your guest thinks of the whole thing. So I'll take my answer off there. I appreciate it.
Oops. Thanks, Carlos. Let's see now what you might have learned in your research, Jeff Wilser, about stress there.
Yeah, thanks, Carlos. He brings up a really good point that, as one psychologist told me, you could almost think of stress as like a turbo button in a video game. And for those folks out there who play video games, the turbo button It is useful in very short bursts, right? Our character can jump higher or run faster or throw fireballs twice as large. But if we keep mashing that turbo button, the character slows down. And I think that stress can be very useful when we apply it selectively. So back to the idea of running from bears, stress is great to sprint away from a bear. However, if we're sprinting all the time, if we're sprinting to go gather wood for the fire, if we're sprinting to whatever else cavemen do, then that is dangerous for us. And so I'm not making the argument in the book that stress is always great. Let's be more stressed. But if we think about not always saying stress is bad, saying, all right, I know at the moment I'm under a tight deadline. I feel stressed with this deadline, and I will harness this stress to get this done. And then tomorrow when I'm finished, I'm going to try and relax about it. I know it's easier said than done, but it's really about framing stress in a way that can help us. And the other thing, last thing I'll say is Kelly McGonigal's book, Upside of Stress, her research suggests that even if folks like Carlos, who are stressed a lot, if they really try and think, okay, I'm stressed, but I'm going to think of it as a good way, longitudinal studies suggest they might feel better about themselves and feel happier long term by kind of flipping that mindset of stress.
I wonder if throughout the day you could sort of allot yourself a stress amount, like I get 5 or 3 moments, I don't know what the right amount would be, to be stressed today, and choose when you apply them. Say, am I going to let this moment stress me out, or should I use my sort of that turbo charge in a different moment? Maybe that might be helpful.
I love that idea, and I bet someone, as we speak, after hearing you say that, is designing this app right now, and we'll see it in the App Store soon.
Well, I hope so, and I'd like a cut. So back to your book, you talk about red meat, and this year there's been quite a fuss over the danger of red meat,
mm-hmm.
and the World Health Organization came out with a study saying red processed meat can cause cancer. That, for many Americans, is bad news. So what is the good news about red meat?
I'm really glad you brought that up, because it's my favorite example of how things get kind of framed and distorted a bit in all different levels of how we kind of talk and think about health news. It is and there have been a million different studies that go back and forth in this stuff, but in the particular example you gave about the processed meat and bacon, most of the headlines said bacon causes cancer. And so it looks like if you just read that headline, nothing else, you think, whoa, if I eat bacon, I am going to die of cancer. That's really scary stuff. If you read a bit deeper, it says, okay, bacon is linked with an increase of a particular kind of stomach cancer by 18%. You think, boy, like 18%. That still sounds really high. 18 is a big number. And if my odds of cancer are 18%, I like bacon, but I don't like it that much. It's still scary. You have to go about 7 paragraphs further. And actually, a lot of stories didn't even bring us up at all. And the first day, almost no one did. To look at what's the absolute risk of that cancer in the first place? And how much is that risk increasing if you eat bacon? So not to get too far in the weeds here, but one way to look at it is that for people who don't, and I'm going to use some kind of average numbers here that aren't exact, but it kind of conveys the point. For folks who don't eat bacon at all, they never touch a slice of bacon in their life, the odds of that particular kind of cancer are around 5%. The study suggests that if one eats a regular diet of bacon, that 5% risk increases by 18%. Now, to clarify, it doesn't mean it goes from 5 to 18. It means the 5% is nudged up by 18%. So to do a little bit of dumb math here, it's 5% times 1.18, which equals, drum roll, 6%. So it's true that bacon is linked with a higher risk of cancer in this study. But when you do the math and you factor in the concept of the absolute risk in the first place, the more comprehensive picture is, the study suggests eating bacon will nudge one's risk of this cancer from 5% to 6%. I did not see any news. I saw no headlines that said bacon links with risk of cancer goes from 5 to 6% because people don't click that. So it's a long-winded way of answering your question of what's the good news. Well, there's no good news saying, yay, eat bacon and you'll live forever, or eat bacon and your risk of cancer goes down. That's not the case. And it might not even be that your risk of cancer is flat, but it's probably not nearly as a material change in risk as we would think from the very scary headlines.
So how do you read an article when you do see and you do want to click on something that says association with X food, I don't mm-hmm. know, some cereal and cancer? How do you examine that?
I think the two biggest questions to ask, and this is one thing I set up a framework for in a book, is what's the absolute risk in the first place? Then how much, three questions actually, what's the absolute risk in the first place? In this case of bacon, this was, all right, the risk of this cancer was 5% no matter what. Second question is, what's the relative risk increase? In this case, 18%, so it goes from 5 to 6. And for some folks, 5 to 6% change is enough to not touch bacon. And that's cool. I respect that. For me, I love bacon, and so for me, 5 to 6% is a rounding error, so I'm willing to accept that risk. And the third question to ask is, what's the dosage? Getting back to the old hobgoblin of moderation, right? It might be that the study suggests, well, in eating 10 pounds of bacon, it increases it, or it might be as one slice. In this case, I think it's a very responsible study that looked at an average serving size of bacon, so I think it's the right dosage they were looking at. But those concepts of absolute risk versus relative risk and dosage, by thinking about those questions when we read health studies, it will change the way we think about our risk factors in our health.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in today for Chris Boyd. This hour, the good news about what's bad for you and the bad news about what's good for you. We're talking with author Jeff Wilser about his new book, and you can join the conversation, share your own unconventional wisdom, or ask a question. Call 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. We'll be back with more from Jeff Wilser after a short break.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think. I'm Lauren Silverman, in today for Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is turning conventional wisdom on its head. He's author of The Good News About What's Bad for You and The Bad News About What's Good for You. So, sorry, listeners, but salad might not deserve its unimpeachable reputation as a health food, according to you, Jeff, right? Tell me about the salads, meals that are masquerading as healthy.
Yes. Yeah, so many salads start out like wonderfully nutritious and healthy, and they are unimpeachable. When you have a bed of lettuce, like, great. You're golden. And by the way, I'm by far not the first one to bring this point up, but it kind of gets lost in a shuffle that when we take that salad and then we glop on, and I'm guilty of this too big time, we say, all right, I'm now going to add on this dressing that has like loaded with sugar, and I'm going, and even fat, quote unquote, fat free dressing is often just stuffed with cheap carbs and sugar, and we'll load up the every possible topping and more bacon. Not that bacon's bad.
So whiskey salads on there,
often, yeah, whiskey beer on there. We're stressed about it. So salads often kind of masquerade as a health food, and are really, you might as well have a burger when you're all said and done with it.
You write in the book that Jack in the Box has a chicken club salad with croutons and ranch, and that clocks you in at 873 calories.
Exactly. And I'm pretty sure you can get a salad burger for less calories than that. And I think there was just, I mean, this is kind of I'm making some cheap jokes at the expense of salad, but it does speak to how often we tend to lionize certain foods. Like, okay, if I'm eating this, then I'm like, I'm totally in great. I'm doing great. No problem. I'm eating lots of salad, eating kale. I'm good. But when you actually look at what's, you know, do the math and think about the calories, it's not necessarily any better than the alternative.
Now, you went on a very strange diet for this book. You ate only junk food for how long?
Yeah, this is, let me again for your listeners say, I do not recommend this to anyone. But in the name of science and to kind of cartoonishly prove a point, for 30 days, actually 33 days, I ate only four food groups: junk food, black coffee, protein shakes, and whiskey. Nothing else. No bread, no meat, no vegetables, no salad, not even any bacon for a month. And I weighed myself before and after. I went to a doctor before and after. I got all my vitals taken. In those 30 days of what I call my junk food cleanse, it's like a juice cleanse, but with junk food, I lost 11 pounds. And my bad cholesterol went down. My good cholesterol went up. My body fat percentage dipped by 2 points. By every objective standard, I was healthier than before I started.
Which is just insane. And of course, you didn't do this for a long period of time. So, again, we're not advocating anyone actually does
not
this.
At all.
But you're trying to show what?
So the one catch, the one thing I did that was very different from Supersize Me was I ate all this crap. But I said, you know what? I am going to stick to the portion sizes. And furthermore, I'm going to cap my calories at a certain amount every day. So I think I targeted a net 1,800 calories. And to prove that at the end of the day, when it comes to weight gain or loss, and not to say this is the only thing that matters about health, not to say that thin equals healthy. That's a very important distinction. There's a longer conversation there. But for the limited scope of weight gain or loss, calories in, calories out is still the ultimate trump card. And while it's no longer at all fashionable to discuss because we talk about things like, you know, what's your macronutrient profile? What's your fat versus carb versus protein ratio? What's, you know, should I have organic, non-organic, paleo, non-paleo, gluten, non-gluten? It's so much. But when we often get so in the weeds of these health issues, sometimes we lose sight of the big picture that calories in, calories out is still the driver. It's the engine for weight gain or loss.
I didn't see this in your book, but maybe you researched it or you have an idea. Are choices good for us or bad for us? Because sometimes I feel like I just get more overwhelmed when I have more choices.
That's hilarious. Actually, there is. It's a great point. There is a segment in the book about that.
Okay, I missed that.
I think you're hitting on the paradox of choice. And I talked to psychologist Barry Schwartz, who wrote The Paradox of Choice, and he fleshes out what philosophers have talked about for in a way for centuries. That when we to your point, when we have like 5,000 options, we almost are overwhelmed and we need three choices, right? So, I mean, there have been in both the world of psychology as well as advertising and marketing, where there's like millions and billions of dollars on the line, they've done plenty of studies showing that people get confused and are less likely to purchase things when they have, if they're looking at 1,000 pairs of jeans, they choose nothing. If they have like 10 pairs of jeans, they can kind of get their brain around that.
Yeah, that definitely is the case when I go to the supermarket and I'm just standing in the aisle looking at the cracker variety, and I'm like, I don't know where to begin.
I know, it's so much. And it also, there's certainly a wing of the of folks who talk about how even in the world of modern dating is our abundance of choice in the dating world with things like Tinder and all of those various tools, is that a good thing or a bad thing? And of course, there's plenty of debates and thoughts about that issue.
Well, I know there are plenty of matchmakers who might be happy to answer that call and just provide you with someone. You write about something that I'm definitely guilty of, multitasking. And I don't know who doesn't do this. So why, and I don't even want to know the answer, but why is multitasking bad?
Well, we all do it, and I feel like it at a gut level, I feel it's getting worse and worse, and I think plenty of studies suggest that too. And I hate to say this, but it might be even worse than we think. There have been psychologists who have done studies suggesting that when you look at – when they actually scan the brains of multitaskers and look at the gray matter and look at how our brains are actually constructed – multitasking might have a negative impact on their very way our brains are wired. And it's tough to get that back. It's harder to constantly. So what we all feel, like probably the folks listening who are, you know, on Instagram while driving, while also, you know, talking to their kid, like all of these things, if we feel in our gut like it's making it harder for us to concentrate, there is science backing that up. And so I think the takeaway, though, is not that, oh, no, we should feel bad about ourselves, but rather, hey, it's a crowded, tough life we're all juggling. But when we're at our jobs, when our boss is asking us to do seven things at once, it might be more healthy for us and also productive. And there are workplace studies that have quantified this, showing workers are more productive when we focus on like one task at a time, as opposed to having 17 windows open and trying to do it all at once.
Yeah, you write that even toggling back and forth between windows like email and PowerPoint, that is actually in studies sapping your productivity.
There's a certain amount of friction. There's a certain amount of energy it takes our brains to go from, you know, back and forth. And who knows what, you know, it might be a century from now, people look back and say, whoa, what were they thinking? Like how, or maybe it might go the other way and they're looking at 17,000 windows. Like, wow, these poor primitive people could only look at 17 windows. We can look at 17,000 windows. So who knows how this will play out.
What do you write or what did you learn about exercise and either the good news about it or the bad news about it?
So sadly, I found no study saying just sit on your couch and you're going to be healthy. Like, I wish that science said that. Alas, it does not. However, I think that there is a point of diminishing returns. And speaking to folks who cover this in detail and speaking to fitness experts, the consensus seems to be that, you know, for people who are running multiple marathons a year, training for those Ironman competitions, there is a higher risk of heart attack for ultra marathoners than not. And at a certain point, our bodies are simply not built for pounding a pavement for 50 and 70 miles. And that's counterproductive. At a certain point, you're just training to run more marathons. You're not getting your body healthier. So I think that the takeaway, I view this actually as good news. I think a takeaway is for someone who's exercising 3-ish times a week, that's probably effectively as healthy as someone who's doing this crazy, you know, all out, you know, Mega Man run. Again, I'm not a fitness coach, so don't take that to the bank, but I think plenty of research suggests that there is diminishing returns and possibly even health hazards at the highest end of those fitness echelons.
What did you take away from the research and the writing of this book? Have you changed your habits at all?
So some concrete things. I eat eggs a lot more than I used to. I used to be kind of scared of them. I thought, well, it's, you know, the cholesterol and it's fatty and eggs every day can't be good for you. But plenty of studies show not the case. Eggs are full of nutritional goodies. And I actually feel in the old days, I had my fat-free cereal and I would crash every morning around 10:30. And I thought it was hypoglycemic. Now I have eggs and some cheese and a little tortilla wrap, and it's delicious, and I feel hungry sated. I do not feel hungry all morning long. And on a more abstract level, it has changed the way I view kind of the way we perceive risk and the way we think about health studies. I think this is a takeaway for everyone else too, that we tend to beat ourselves up for our choices. And we tend to think that, it's what I enjoy doing is is not the same as what's good for me. They're mutually exclusive. And so we kind of like punish ourselves and, oh, I shouldn't have had that steak, or I shouldn't have had butter on my toast, or I don't want to take this nap, or I feel guilty watching TV, or I'm not eating enough kale. So we feel bad, when the reality is plenty of the science says they're not mutually exclusive. In the right dosage, doing things that we actually enjoy doing can actually be good for us. And it's probably not as bad as we thought in moderation.
So one topic we touched on, but I want to get back to, is we were talking about the importance of alcohol in moderation. But you mm-hmm. specifically write about whiskey. Why whiskey?
Well, I think whiskey, like tequila and wine and beer, and to be very frank, the experts I spoke to said there's not really one definitive holy grail of body research saying the healthiest alcohol is X. Mm. In fact, one alcohol expert I spoke to, and I love that they're alcohol experts, by the way, that's my new career, he said that the reason different studies, some suggest whiskey is the healthiest, some suggest red wine, some suggest beer. So the reason that there's contradictions in these is because the main healthy ingredient of alcohol is alcohol, and that in the same, it thins the blood. It is been shown, at least suggested, that our risk of cardiovascular events, of heart attacks, that risk is curbed by having alcohol in moderation. And so to the extent that it's about helping your heart, whether it's whiskey or beer or wine or tequila or vodka, they all contain alcohol. The other upside of whiskey, though, is it's not loaded with carbs in the way beer is. So, at a purely joking level, I thought it'd be hilarious if there were some experiment where one fraternity was told to drink only beer for a year, and one fraternity of the same size, you know, same number of guys drank only whiskey, and we'd see the overall effect of their health a year later. I hope some college conducts this experiment sometime. I want to read this study.
All right, one final piece of good news that's bad for you. Throw it at us.
So, profanity. We tend to think of profanity as something we feel guilty about. And what I was delighted to speak to a scientist in the UK who has a theory that there's a biological purpose for profanity, and that it actually makes us more resistant to pain. We can better tolerate pain. And so he conducted one of my favorite experiments in the world. He had one group of student volunteers submerge their hand in ice and yell profanity. Other group submerge their hand in ice and not yell. And in profanity, the F-bomb droppers could hold their hands in ice longer. So if you want to tolerate pain better, cuss more.
Love it. You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in today for Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Jeff Wilser, author of The Good News About What's Bad for You and The Bad News About What's Good for You. Thanks for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Knabe. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Kristen Taylor. You can contact us via email at think@kera.org. Thanks for listening and have a great day.